Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
All right. Well, thanks for tuning in, everybody. I'm Patrick Martins, your host of The Main Course. This is the 202nd episode, and we are very excited to have a very prominent author in the sustainable world, Rowan Jacobson, on, and he's going to come and talk about his newest article for a great magazine called Orion. We're big fans. It's called From Farm to Table, Building Local Infrastructure to Support Local Food. It's a covers really food hubs is a big part of what he covers, and that's really an issue that's very important to me because of what Heritage Foods does by kind of being, I guess, a food hub for small family farmers of pigs, ducks, geese, turkeys, and goats around the country. So we're going to have him on, and then we're also going to have Eric Hoffner on, and he is one of the freelance energies at Orion. It's an all freelance organization from the writing team. So he's going to be on and talk a little bit about that important organization. So stay tuned, and thanks for listening to The Main Course. All right, so here we are back on The Main Course, broadcasting live out of Roberta's Brooklyn. I am Patrick Martins, and we are really happy to have the author, Rowan Jacobson, with us, calling him from Vermont. Thanks for being with us, Rowan.
My pleasure.
Well, I've read one of your books. For my book, your one on terroir, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But most recently, along with the many, many books you've written about agriculture and the earth and sustainability, issues like that, you wrote a beautiful piece called From Farm to Table, Building Local Infrastructure to Support Local Food for Orion, which is a magazine and a very popular website, and they bring people together. And it was a very, very interesting article about food hubs and moving product on a grander scale. And one of the things, my first question to you is a very interesting line that you wrote. And you say that one of the reasons why the local food movement isn't growing is that it's hit a wall, is what you wrote. So could you explain that to our listeners, how the local food movement has hit the wall?
Yeah, we caught a little flack on that one, as you can imagine. But I didn't really intend, but the what that was really referring to is kind of what's, you know, when we think of local food, we kind of think of farmers markets. I think, you know, that's sort of the original outlet for a lot of sustainable food and organic food, and for a while that world was growing really fast. You know, farmers markets kept springing up in places that we hadn't seen them before, but that phenomenon has kind of changed lately. There's still a lot of farmers markets springing up new, but the consumer base for those farmers markets isn't growing as quickly. So what's happened is, even though we've gone from like 2,000 farmers markets to 8,000 farmers markets in this country, a lot of those farmers markets are just cutting the same pie of consumers a little bit skinnier. So that market is basically, the farmers market world has really matured. And so if the local food and sustainable food world is going to continue to grow and expand, we have to find other outlets. We have to reach all the other people who aren't visiting farmers markets. And the truth is that even though those of us who are involved in this world, it seems like everyone you know shops at farmers markets. The truth is that it's less than 1% of the food dollars spent in the U.S. So there's a lot of lot of that pie is elsewhere.
So sales not keeping pace with the growth of new farmers markets. Do you attribute that to a lack of food hubs? I mean, it was a big theme of this piece. So, I mean, did you believe that before, and do you believe that now, that it's the lack of hubs that's the reason?
Well, the food hubs are what allow small scale farmers to hopefully reach other outlets besides the farmers market. And that's really the great hope of food hubs, and it's why a lot of foundations and also the USDA are putting a lot of resources toward growing the food hub world. And I guess, we should probably define food hub for everybody out there. Mm-hmm. But basically, a food hub is any kind of entity that aggregates produce from small-scale farms and helps distribute it to stores and other consumer outlets. So farmers markets are separate from that, but the hope with food hubs is that all these small-scale farms that have not had access to other markets because they're being served by very large wholesale distributors, through food hubs they'd be able to distribute their product to places that it wasn't traditionally being seen. And that is happening.
Hmm. Now, one of the questions I had about these hubs, because essentially my company, Heritage Foods, is a hub of sorts.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, yeah.
Yeah, so wait a second. Whose interview is this? No, just kidding. Yeah, you can ask me at the end. Please hold all questions till the end. No, just kidding. So
yeah.
Who are the salespeople of this? Because one of the things that I thought your article, what I left me wanting, was to understand who is actually selling this stuff, because the ideas all sound great, but when a guy brings in 500 pigs worth of salamis or part fruits or vegetables, whatever it is, who's the one is that the hub's responsibility? I mean, could you speak to some of the different models for hubs? Because without the sale, it's all just an academic enterprise, right?
Exactly. And, one thing is there's a lot of different definitions of food hub out there. It kind of keeps expanding. So depending on who you're talking about, different people are handling the sales. Sometimes a food hub is really purely just an aggregator where, single farms, wholesale distributors are not interested in buying from single farms. It's just too small to be worth their trouble. But if 10 farms or 20 small farms can group their produce together, then they can suddenly get it up to numbers that the wholesalers can then work with that.
So what experiences have you had then? Is there one invoice that comes? Are these bigger distributors that start a wing of their distribution company that says, now we'll bring you guys on? Or are these farmers who together form a corporation and sell food under a certain banner and logo? I mean, what are the most successful things you've seen out there in terms of the actual nitty-gritty of who gets paid and how does it get divided?
Right. Well, actually I would say is the most successful model I've seen, and these guys didn't necessarily call themselves a food hub originally, but I think, looking at it from 2014, they're one of the best models, is Jasper Hill Cheese, the cheese sellers of Jasper Hill. You're probably familiar with their cheeses, right?
Yep, and they've carved out caves in the mountains of Vermont and aged them for the farmers, right? And they have a deal where it's like they'll pay 50% up front and then 50% once they sell the cheese.
Exactly, and they didn't plan to get into that whole world. They created that from their own experience, which was, they started off just making really good cheese. They got some attention for it right off the bat, but they found it incredibly difficult to handle the fulfillment end of things, not only just the aging of the cheese, but the fulfillment, all the whole business part of distribution and fulfillment. So they realized that their experience was common in a lot of the cheese world, the artisan cheese world, where there are a lot of people who loved farming or loved making cheese, but just could not deal with the other part of it. Mm-hmm. So that's why they created these state-of-the-art cellars in a hillside in Vermont where they can age the cheeses perfectly, because a lot of cheese you know, product gets lost to things that happen in the cellar in the cheese world if you don't have that kind of level of quality control. Mm-hmm. But they also have the whole distribution network. They've got the, you know, the loading dock, and they have the marketing part of it. They can actually, they're now selling cheeses for a number of different farmers who just have to deliver their new cheeses once a month or once a week to the sellers. So that, to me, is a really successful example of a food hub where it's allowing all these very small-scale artisan cheese makers to reach markets all over the place that they would otherwise have no access to.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, as a salesman myself, you know, I'm always interested in the romanticization of people who, you know, sell in the spirit of the door-to-door vacuum cleaner salesman or encyclopedia salesman. I mean, there needs to be a new breed of people, a new class of society for the, you know, in large part, you know, starting in these food hubs that are famous for, I can move anything. I have 200 accounts that know me. And so anyway, it's why I asked you that question. And talking about breeding a new generation of food hub people, is this true what you write, that there's an online dating service for wholesale food buyers and sellers?
Well, that's a particular example of a type of food hub that I think of as like a virtual food hub. That one's out in the Pacific Northwest. But basically all it is a website with some, you know, good functionality where, you know, on one end you've got chefs who are members, and on the other end you've got farmers who are members. And so when a farmer or fisherman or anybody who's got you know, interesting, sustainable produce or other food products, they can just post that it's available. Here's what I've got, you know, here's how much. And then chefs know to look there every day, and they can just, you know, say, I want it. And then that is a purely virtual food hub. They don't handle the logistics of the actual delivery at all. That's between the buyer and the seller.
Well,
but I agree with you that you know, most of us who are interested in sustainable food got into it not because we love to sell stuff, but people who love to sell stuff are an essential part of the process. And when you were getting, you know, when you were doing Heritage Foods, that must have been something that you had to think about pretty quickly, right?
Yes, well, but the original reason I asked for the dating site, I really wished it was a dating service where new children would be born. My wife is a cheesemonger, and we always joke that we're going to breed our son Max to be a baker, because with my meats and her cheeses, if only he could bake bread, we could be selling sandwiches all over the country. But no, I did ask that more seriously because it shows the diversity of food hubs. I did enjoy in your article how it made beautiful these things that are very simple, like an empty warehouse floor or a loading dock that is tall enough for a truck to be able to deliver pallets on and off. Those simple things are really the tools by which the local food movement is going to grow. So I thought I did enjoy reading that. And I also liked this definition you were talking about how food hubs are not very profitable, and Amanda Oborn, who directs the conservation organization's EcoTrust Food Hub, she said, how could they be profitable? They're competing in one of the world's most cutthroat businesses, which often operates on net margins of less than 1%, and they are trying to return more money to the farmers, operate on smaller scales, and provide additional social and environmental services. So, I mean, it is a big challenge, and it's interesting to see how, whether it be virtual or actual infrastructure, you know, with concrete and all, it's there are many different forms of how people are connecting buyers with good food.
Right. And yeah, I think originally there was all this excitement about food hubs over the past 5 or 6 years, and there was foundational money to get them started. So a lot of people went in with very noble ideas about, you know, taking the, you know, this great organic lettuce from the small farm and getting it to the market. And they may, you know, they're even, you know, they would survey people in local, who ran local stores, and would you like to sell more local food? Yeah, sure. But then, you know, when it's on these tiny scales and it comes in and it's four times that expensive, then suddenly they don't buy it. So I think a lot of food hubs have a charitable goal as part of their core mission. So they're trying to get more food into the school systems or trying to reach neighborhoods that have not traditionally had much fresh produce to work with. And so in that you know, if you're in that kind of situation, then you can't really be expected to be profitable because you're taking on all these other roles at the same time. So there's a role for foundational support in an ongoing capacity for some food hubs. But then there's others that are really looking to compete against the large-scale distributors, and so they need to be efficient and kind of think like a profitable business.
Yep. Cisco writes on the sides of their truck, service you can count on, right? So that's a big thing if you're going to really want people to switch over. So you talk about certain states having more food hubs. You know, there are many, many food hubs around the country, but there are still many states that don't have any food hubs at all. Could you break down, like, can you generalize which states have? I mean, is it like red states versus blue states? Is it population? How do you really define where the concentration is?
Yeah, I think, let's see, thinking about it, I would say that it's kind of, a lot of it is in the places that you'd suspect it to be, in places that have a strong interest in local food economies or in healthier organic foods. So the Northeast is chock full of food hubs. Mm-hmm. You can't swing an organic carrot in Vermont without hitting a food hub. Pacific Northwest is strong. Wisconsin is amazingly strong. The concept has really taken off, especially all around the Madison area. But then, you know, another place that is very, very strong with food hubs, I noticed, was Virginia and North Carolina, which is maybe a little bit less, wouldn't be your first guess, but I think those two states both have very strong small farm traditions still. So I think you're seeing a big wave of food hubs there too. The Midwest and the Rocky Mountain West and the Southwest are pretty weak so far.
And all right, well, that's interesting. It's funny to think like certain states actually being healthier as a state. You know, the people in a state being healthier based off of food hubs. Who knows if that'll be. A connection that they can draw, a correlation they'll be able to draw in a century or two. Where there's more food hubs, the people live longer.
It's a good PhD dissertation right there.
Yes, one day for sure, maybe for my son or grandson. Another thing I like very much in my book, I have a chapter called Give the People What They Want, and it's talking about how, you know, the meatball shop here in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, you know, gives people basically a delicious meal with a side and like a vegetable side and bread for not too much more than what it costs to eat at McDonald's. And, you know, this whole concept of prepared food being a, you know, easy, quick meal for people, and it's kind of what people want. And you touched upon that very well and talking about how they don't necessarily want vegetables. They want Joe's soups. They want Pete's meats. So could you talk about prepared food as one of the answers to getting people to eat better?
Yeah, you know, that was one thing that surprised me. Well, I think I probably had certain preconceptions going into the article that, you know, kind of the whole food desert idea that if we can just get lots of fresh produce to people into neighborhoods, then people will start using it and eating healthier. And most people I talk to who have been involved in that have found that that's often not the case, that, that you've fresh produce makes people feel guilty, you know, because it it rots in your fridge if you don't deal with it pretty quickly. So if you really want to change America's eating habits for the better, people I was talking to were saying, you know, give them food that is ready to go, healthy food that's ready to go, and even give them frozen food that's frozen healthy food that's ready to go. So rather than try to change them to meet your vision of what how healthy people should eat, give them healthy foods that work for their lifestyle.
I've been getting so much crap for saying that. Everyone's like, what are you talking about? We need to be cooking. And I'm like thinking, listen, if all these people are eating McDonald's in the back of their SUVs, that's the game, you know? That is the game. You also talk about adding value. You had somebody that you quoted that say, how do you value add? Or through processing, through delaying the availability of a product until you can get a higher price, storage, by getting your product to places that you haven't had it in the past, distribution, and by running your business better, incubation. So that adding value, for instance, to a ham where all you have to do is heat it and eat it, could you speak to value added and that importance and also how good all the value added things are? Because I imagine just because you're a great pig farmer doesn't mean you're a great sausage maker. So can you explain the whole value added importance?
Yeah, well, that is actually a really good point, that just because you're good at one end of it doesn't mean you're going to be good at the other. And I think that's one thing you're seeing with more of these food hubs is the processing end of it, and not just the facilities for processing, but the expertise for guiding you through that process or for taking care of that process for you. But yeah, you know, that was another preconception shot down for me going into this article. It turns out it's really hard to make money off of purely fresh veggies. The markup on them just can't be that high before people start resisting. But somehow we value stuff like cheeses and cured meats and even processed foods like soups and sauces differently, and we're willing to pay more of a markup for good stuff. So at least what we're seeing here in Vermont is more and more people kind of switching over to meat, and especially now that we're getting some food hubs coming in that can handle the slaughtering and processing part of the infrastructure, so that you can be a small farmer and you've got somebody who can take care of, you know, just a few pigs a month or whatever for you. We're seeing a lot of people going over toward that end of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that will be a trend, whether it's processed sauces or whether it's more high-end meats and dairy products.
Yeah, adding value. I mean, I think you said this somewhere in your article, you know, a fresh ham sells for two, a cured ham can sell for 10 a pound, you know, so there is profits to be made. Well, it was a very interesting article, and, you know, I think people should subscribe to Orion. It's a great organization, and their magazine is great. They cover very important issues, and in the beginning of the article, you follow Pete, the charcutier who makes prosciutto, coppa, guanciale, lonza, all exuding a vibe of porky seduction, as Rowan writes. So just to shift gears a little bit, I know you've written a bunch of books. I want to ask you what that's like, because I wrote a book and it was hell. I was always wanting to go outside and I couldn't, you know, but it was very, very difficult. But I wanted to ask you, tell me the geography of oysters, West Coast oysters in particular. That was one of your books.
Well, geography of oysters, it's kind of a guide to oysters all around the country, both East Coast and West Coast and Gulf Coast.
So what are the best oysters in this country? Is there a certain terroir that's considered the best or better than others?
There's various places that are really prized for having particularly good oysters. Like, one example is the Damariscotta River in Maine. Seems like almost every oyster that comes out of the Damariscotta is superb. But really, there's good oysters being found in many places all over the country now. But every bay kind of imparts a different flavor to its oyster based on the salinity and the minerals and the algae in the water and so on. So,
and wild never struck me as being much tastier than farmed in the way people write about it. I mean, I don't actually know when I eat oysters if they're farmed or wild, but I know with salmon that's a huge issue. Is it a big issue with oysters and crustaceans?
It's not with oysters, and in fact, I agree with you. I actually generally find the wild ones to be worse, and it really has to do with lifestyle. Like, the reason we value wild salmon or various other wild animals is because they're living a very different lifestyle than the domestic equivalents, which are caged in pens. But oysters never move their entire life. So whether they're wild, they don't even know whether they're wild or you know, farmed. It's all the same to them. They just crack open their shell a quarter inch, suck water in, filter the water, and that's what they do all day long. So they're actually the perfect food to farm, in a sense, because they take to it very happily.
And another book you wrote was Terroir. How did you choose those terroirs? If I recall correctly, it's been a bit, but you picked, I believe, 5 or 6 terroirs that you covered pretty much in depth?
Yeah, I do 12 different 12. Foods in the book. And it kind of came because once I was working on my oyster book, I started realizing that terroir, or merroir, as they're starting to call it in the oyster world, was such an important key to the flavor of oysters. And once I started, once I kind of had my terroir glasses on, I started seeing that as a factor in lots of other foods, too. And in Europe, they've kind of always had this attitude that we can't really have terroir over here because we haven't been at it long enough. We haven't been paying attention to the land long enough compared to their
That's
wine
so
industry.
Obnoxious.
It is obnoxious.
But now I will say to defend them, though, in my book, I've always been proud of this, and it's not that smart a thing, but I invented a word called tetoir, which is the French for head, and it's the knowledge of the brain and the hands and the people and the locus and a place in the world that, you know, expertise breeds more expertise, and that's true. We might lack the tetoir, but the terroir, I mean, the whole world was started at the same time. I mean, the Big Bang started everything, not just France.
Exactly. Good line. But yeah, so that's why I wanted to focus on North American examples, like foods that really there was a strong sense of place in them.
And what would just speak to the terroir? Is there a terroir you think about more than others now that you've written the book a few years ago?
I see it all over the place, and salmon is one of my favorite examples. You mentioned wild salmon, and again, every river is different. Mm-hmm. Salmon coming from every river will taste different based on the physical characteristics of that river, mm-hmm. and also because of the genetics. Because salmon return to their home river, they live in the ocean during almost all their life, but they're born in a particular river and return to that exact river to breed. So you get different genetics for the salmon in every river, mm-hmm. who have evolved to the physical nature of that river, how mm-hmm. fast or slow it is, how long it is, things like that, mm-hmm. which really affect them. So salmon, to me, is kind of one of the really like spectacular examples of terroir.
Yeah. No, it is amazing, the salmon. I'm always amazed by that fish and what they do and how that works. Now you're working on a new book on apples, is that right?
Yeah, I just finished checking the page proofs this morning, actually. So that'll be out in September, and it's kind of a big full color book. It's kind of apple pornography, you know. Lots of color pictures of beautiful apples and then telling stories of about 120 different heirlooms and modern classics.
So how do you do this? You just sit at your desk 10 hours a day and just pound it out? How are you so prolific? How do you discipline yourself and still, you know, get out and have a family and stay in shape and, you know, go out and eat? What's your schedule like to write so many books?
Well, you know, the mortgage bill is an excellent disciplinarian. It's my job. It's what I love to do, but it's also my job, so I have to do it. So I do try to put it in. I put in an 8-hour day, not straight writing, because mm-hmm. I don't know what you found, but I found that I can kind of go in 2-hour chunks, and then my brain is kind of has run out of some key nutrient. I don't know what it is, but so then I have to switch to doing non-writing tasks. You know, the other parts of having a life, like email and so on. And then I can get back and maybe 3 2-hour chunks in a day is about all the writing I think anyone can really get in.
My writing schedule was determined by the quality of the weed that I had that day. If it was great weed, I could go 5 hours and then fall asleep. If it was terrible, I'd get into a fight with my co-author and then, no, that didn't necessarily happen. Jack, edit that out. But, Rowan, thank you so much. We're big fans of prolific writers about these issues, and you're certainly one of the most prolific. And congratulations on partnering with Orion, and we look forward to your future works.
Thanks. Great talking to you, Patrick.
Bye, Rowan.
Teach the old ways to the young and keep our
before, but something's different. Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surreyfarms.com.
The song you're hearing right now is called Beast in Air, Beast in Water by our friends Snowmine. And this is HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Well, that was a great interview with Rowan Jacobson, the author of a number of books, and most recently a great article from Farm to Table, Building Local Infrastructure to Support Local Food for Orion Magazine. And now our guest is the man behind the article and behind much of what goes on at Orion, Eric Hoffner. Welcome, Eric.
Hi, thanks, Patrick.
Yeah, well, you've been on before, and we are big fans of everything you do. So, you know, just to catch people up, tell people what you do at Orion and what Orion's mission is in the sustainable world.
Sure, thanks. And to be clear, I'm the outreach fellow here. I'm not an editor or anything like that. So somebody else went out and found Rowan for us and got him to write that piece, which really has been so great. I've been loving sharing that around. And that's really what I do for Orion, is to get the ideas that are in this magazine out in the world and really as far as they'll go. So it's really fun for me because I enjoy what Orion's about, which is, you know, we're a literary magazine of culture, place, and nature, really, I guess. And so sustainable ag comes into that really strongly. So we'll have something like Rowan's piece in there alongside a beautiful gallery of photographs and maybe a short story from Luis Urrea or something like that. And, you know, it's really fun for me. And being a nonprofit and ad-free, that means, you know, we don't place ads anywhere to tell people to read Orion. So I basically do all the legwork that gets us out there in lieu of those ads. Mm-hmm. So I'm the face, I guess, in a way.
And what are some of the new ideas over the past years and currently or in recent issues that you bring to the table, to the national conversation, that other publications don't, or, you know, that are just new to Americans?
Well, one of the things we're excited about right now is a new project, a two-year project that we're calling Reimagining Infrastructure. And I think that's a pretty good example of what we're trying to push forward, which, in anything, Orion is trying to just surface new ideas, things that are like a little bit further out beyond the current conversation, the culture. So we're really zeroed in on infrastructure in society, and, you know, how we're seeing how, you know, our grid isn't up to snuff. You know, transportation needs to be better. More people want to take transportation publicly, and it can't move the number of people we would like to move. So we've got a two-year content project going right now called Reimagining Infrastructure, and Rowan's is one of the pieces in that series that we just started in the late summer, because obviously food is a big part of the infrastructure that we need to figure out the back end for, so that more people can enjoy the best food. But other stories from that series include Waterworks we ran in the fall, which was about just really cool ways that cities are learning to capture stormwater, you know, the stuff that jams the sewer mains and all that. Well, what if you can catch all that stuff off the roofs and off the streets and do something really cool with it, like, you know, grow trees and things like that. So those are the sort of things we're working on. And then the current issue, there's a really cool story about this town in Kansas, which was blown off the map by an E5 tornado maybe 3 years ago now. and just entirely devastated, you know, just a few things left. And they decided they're going to rebuild, but they're going to rebuild sustainably. So green buildings, you know, gardens, all that means. And it's interesting because it's a farm town in Kansas, and they're, you know, they said, well, we think sustainability really encapsulates conservative thought. So that, I mean, that was a really, that's a really fun idea to come out of the middle of the country. So we're, you know, we're, that's another infrastructure thing. Like, how do you rebuild after a big storm, you know?
So if someone is going to listen to this piece and then go and tell their brother-in-law or sister or mom about infrastructure, I mean, what would you say are the one or two most pressing national concerns when it comes to infrastructure? I mean, like on a national level, I mean, what are the first two things that you would wish Congress or private donors would put their attention to? Because, I mean, there's a million, I'm sure.
Yeah, I would say that public transportation is a major one. And the information infrastructure as well as the grid, I think, is way up there, as well as coastal infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Certainly, you know, we saw what happened with Sandy. Yeah. and the ways that we haven't been prepared and ways we can be. And I think it's really well summed up in our next issue, and we have a writer from Boston writing about coastal infrastructure and how you can be more ready for storms like Sandy. I mean, it's just so devastating what happened to the New York area and New Jersey, goodness. So I would really, I guess I told you four there, but those are the ones that really come up for me.
And what does the future hold for you, Eric, and for Orion? I mean, you personal level with your studies and curiosities in this field, someone who has built up such a terroir, to use a word that we coined earlier, but also, you know, for Orion.
Well, we're looking forward to more features from this series, which folks can read, actually, orionmagazine.org/infrastructure. You'll see all the things, including Rowan's article right there is linked directly. But we're working to relaunch our website this year, which is always exciting, be a little more accessible and bring more good things into it, kind of like, I guess, didn't Heritage just relaunch your website?
Yeah.
That's really good.
We're about to relaunch the Heritage Foods one, but the Heritage Radio one has been reconceived to include a news component with three-minute stories. So, yes, we've gotten a lot of positive feedback about that change.
Yeah, I think it looks really good.
That's great.
Yeah. Well, so, yeah, be looking for the same kind of things from us, like really good cutting-edge ideas and publishing on multiple platforms and small-run print-on-demand books, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very interesting. There's a lot of crap out there in the world, and Orion is one of the good things, and it deserves a much wider audience. And we're big fans, and complete solidarity with what you dedicate your life to and what the staff does. One last question. How do ideas get exchanged there? Do you have daily or monthly meetings? I mean, what is the format for how an idea becomes an article? How does that work?
Sure. Well, Orion is 100% freelance written, so we rely on people to surface ideas for us, mm-hmm. and then we meet monthly to vet all the new ideas and to put some of them into the into the pipeline to become stories. Some of them, you know, some of the stories we have, like this infrastructure thing, we've gone out and found people, but we don't have any staff writers, so we really rely on the community. And that's what Orion is at its best, is it's a community of writers and thinkers who keep bringing these new ideas up for the wider community. So,
how far ahead are you published? I mean, do you already have your June issue in the work?
Yeah.
I mean, is it already?
Yeah,
done?
July, August is pretty much lined up now. So, yeah, pretty much 6 to 8 months is what our schedule. Yeah,
6 to 8 months, and people can subscribe. How much is a subscription?
It is $35 for 6 issues, but we got a nice and pain-free offer. You can get a free trial issue of Orion if you go to orionmagazine.org/free trial. you get a copy of it just mailed to you, and if you like it, great. You can continue receiving it, and it's half-price subscription for that first year. Or if you don't like it, you can just keep it and give it to your brother-in-law.
But, that weird brother-in-law.
Yeah, he might really like
it. He needs some changing of opinions. No, not talking about mine in particular. But anyway, Eric, thank you so much. Thanks for introducing us to Rowan and getting him to do the interview. And thank you for spending some time with us. And we really recommend that all of our listeners subscribe to Orion Magazine. So thanks again, Eric.
Fantastic, Patrick. Appreciate it.
We will be back next week, and in the meantime, stay tuned for Arts and Seizures with Mike Edison and Judy McGuire.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.